This is Gene Lozano. I'm the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. And to my left is Bernice Kandarian, president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. We want to make a few opening comments, and then we're going to go into a real exciting, innovative workshop that I think you're all going to really enjoy today. For, I don't know how many conventions, there has been stated by a lot of people within the organization outside, we really want to learn about how we can advocate and make changes in our environment, the programs we deal with, and so forth. And that there's been requests for training. And we've tried to provide some training at different times. Well, this morning, what we are going to do is first start off with one of those advocacy techniques or methods that we have used and worked very closely, structured negotiations. And so we want to touch upon a little bit of that and one of the greatest successes. And then afterwards, we're going to have a workshop. In that workshop, you're going to learn a lot about structured negotiations, the different approaches, the nuts and bolts of how to do it. And we have panelists who will be able to tell you what you need to do and interact with you on this thing. So first, to kick off, we want to have, want to let you know, how did the members of the blind and visually impaired community work with legal persons to bring up and the city of San Francisco to develop an accessible pedestrian signal program that is a innovative and national model that is being replicated, as we talk, in other places around the country. And so I would like to introduce to you a longtime friend of the organization and a lawyer who has worked with us on this accessible pedestrian signals and many other things. And I'd like for us to give her a big hand, Lainey Feingold.
Thanks, Gene. Good morning, everyone, and I'm glad to be here at the CCB convention, although I almost can't hear myself because Dan is talking. Okay, so if I get distracted, just, you know, wave. If I seem to be losing my line, just wave your hand, and I'll try to get back on track. Like Gene said, I've been working with the CCB. This is a 15th year. We started the idea of doing structured negotiations in 1995 on the issue of talking ATMs. And for those of you who don't know, California Council of the Blind was the first organization in the country to advocate for talking ATMs in a structured legal way. And California Council of the Blind, if you didn't see it, just last month did a joint press release with Bank America announcing that every single solitary, as we used to say, every single solitary Bank America ATM in the country is now a talking ATM, which is over 18,000. And that all started with California Council of the Blind advocacy and the advocacy of individuals within California Council of the Blind. So in the past 15 years, we've done about 36, 37 different structured negotiations. And while I love them all, a few are my favorites. And one of my favorites is the San Francisco APS results that we're talking about this morning. And Ed Tsui from the city is going to talk after I do this brief sort of introduction to the issue. So like Gene said, the San Francisco Accessible Pedestrian Signal... there's my distraction again. The San Francisco Accessible Pedestrian Signal, which we call APS Settlement, is really a national model. And the California Council of the Blind, I think this
Please
is...
Please shut the door.
This is being streamed, and people really need to know that advocacy is at the heart of the success of the Accessible Pedestrian Signal Settlement. We've had incredible cooperation from the City of San Francisco, which, do you prefer Ed or Eddie?
Eddie
is going to talk more about. But before lawyers got involved, before structured negotiations was considered, the residents of San Francisco who are blind and visually impaired began asking for signals to be installed. And that is really the key to the whole process. You know, when we get these settlements, a lot of attention gets paid to the press release or the legal settlement agreement or the lawyers or the method. But really, it started with individuals knowing that there was such a thing as accessible pedestrian signal, and understanding that they needed to ask for installation and knowing how to ask. Now, what happened with the APS is, despite phenomenal individual advocacy by blind individuals and organizations in San Francisco, it was necessary to get lawyers involved to really get the ball rolling and to create a structure for discussion. But that ball never would have moved an inch were it not for the individual advocacy. So I just want to reference, in addition to California Council of the Blind, the Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and the San Francisco Independent Living Resource Center were the three organizations, the CCB, the ILRC, and the Lighthouse, that worked in coalition to approach the city on the APS issue. And I think that's really important. You know, CCB is a strong organization, but all strong organizations become stronger when working in coalition. So to me, the APS agreement is a great example of how the whole San Francisco community got together to work on an issue of critical safety. San Francisco, Eddie will get to tell the fun part about how great it's doing now, but honestly, when we started, there weren't any APS in the city of San Francisco. There was one or two sort of as a demo, but basically there weren't any in the city, and individual CCB members and Lighthouse staff, ILRC staff, put together a list, spent a lot of time prioritizing, because it was, and this is another key factor, change can't happen overnight. And there is a fine line, but in each advocacy situation, a decision has to be made about what sort of incremental steps are okay, what is too slow, what is going to be workable for the entity you're dealing with. And the San Francisco community did a really wonderful job in prioritizing intersections, because it does cost money to install APS, and they have to be, there's a lot of work that Eddie will talk a little bit about behind the scenes and getting them installed. So the idea of prioritizing and recognizing that APS can't, you're not going to wake up one morning and have them in every intersection in your neighborhood. So that was another great part of the individual and organizational advocacy. One of the things I like to say is that the quality of patience is a really important quality, and I think underlies the success of structured negotiations. Not patience like sit back and do nothing and hope something will happen eventually, but patience coupled with fortitude in recognizing that it takes time and it takes perseverance, and you have to stay on top of things, but everything's not going to happen at once. I see David Jackson in the audience. He is a perfect example of the perfect kind of patience. He had an intersection in particular that he needed an APS at to cross safely, and I would say, David, you are steadfast and patient, and was one of the many people who contributed to the success of the overall project. So I think with that, Gene, unless you wanted me to address anything in particular, I think I should turn it over to Eddie. to talk about how the agreement itself has been implemented. Just one more background thing. We wrote the letter to the city as lawyers on behalf of the Independent Living Resource Center, the Lighthouse, and the California Council of the Blind, as well as Damian Pickering, who was an individual on the letter. I believe we wrote the letter in 04, and the settlement agreement was signed in 2007. So during that period, there was a lot of important work that was done with the city, but the actual legal agreement itself, it was a 2.5-year time between when we first contacted the city as lawyers, of course the community had contacted the city before then, and 2007 when we had the agreement. It's now 2010, and the city has surpassed the goals of the agreement. And I think I just want to personally express my thanks to the city of San Francisco, represented here today by Eddie, for just really kind of validating that collaboration with the community really brings incredible results. So, to you.
Thank you, Elaine. Yes, I have to piggyback on what Elaine said. We're very fortunate that the city of San Francisco was actually receptive and did not have to be forced to come to the table. They were open-minded, not saying that they embraced everything initially, but wanted to hear what we had to say and listened. You don't always get that, and that was one thing that I feel that was we were very fortunate, a starting point, that we had a governmental entity and its staff that were willing to sit at the table and listen to us. And since then, as you're going to hear just within just a few minutes, you're going to hear how the technical specifications that came out of our structure negotiations, how the city is utilizing those and is trying and how they've made them workable within the community, especially, you know, like issues of complaints from the community that they're too loud and, you know, and how to still have them, the signals, without them being turned off. And so there. So this morning, we're very fortunate to have Eddie Sue, who is a signal traffic engineer with the City of San Francisco, City and County of San Francisco, who's connected with the Metropolitan Transportation Agency within that a governmental entity, and has had a great deal of hands-on work in implementing the APS program in the city. So let's give Eddie a hand.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Lainey. Hi, good morning. My name is Eddie Sui, and as Gene and Lainey mentioned, I'm the traffic signal engineer for the City of San Francisco with the Municipal Transportation Agency. And one of my duties as traffic signal engineer, is to oversee and coordinate the design and installation and, to some extent, the maintenance of APS in the city. And this morning I'm going to be talking about our APS program in the city from a little bit from its inception, which I wasn't as involved in as I was later on, to the project itself, which I started getting involved in towards the latter half of the pilot project, and then on to the widespread installation, which I was fully involved in. I'm going to go over some of the design and maintenance challenges that we faced during the past few years, and among other things. Now, before we get started, I want to introduce or give a little background or history about other audible signals that we've used in the city. Prior to installing APS, we've had one chirp and cuckoo audible signal installed at 19th Avenue in Holloway, right outside the San Francisco State University campus. And once we had the APS, we replaced that with the APS. We've also had a couple of locations downtown on Market Street near the Powell Street turnaround where we had talking signs. Both of these technologies had their disadvantages. The chirp and cuckoo was relatively loud, and we've gotten noise complaints from neighboring residents. And whenever there are streets that don't line up with the cardinal directions, northeast, southwest, the chirp and cuckoo is kind of misleading and confusing. With the talking signs, they're more useful than the chirping cuckoo audible signal, but it requires the user to have and to carry a receiver, which sometimes it's not always practical. So for these reasons, the city of San Francisco never really took off on a widespread use of either of these technologies. So along came the APS, and as Lainey's mentioned, as part of the structured negotiation, we worked together with the Lighthouse of the Blind, with the Council of the Blind, California Council of the Blind, the Independent Living Resource Center, and we developed an APS program. And we wanted to have a program to systematically install APS in the city over the next few years. We had some specific requirements that we wanted these devices and what kind of information that they give out. We started looking around to other cities to see what their best practices were for installation and operation, although I believe there weren't too many around, so we didn't get an abundant amount of information from other cities and what their experiences were. And we also worked with the manufacturers of APS to see what was actually technically feasible and possible. Now, over the course of the work, we've developed a set of technical specifications that stated what essential features and functions these APS units must have, and what the installation and operational requirements should be, what message should be used during the walk interval, which is probably one of the most important things of APS, whether that should be a fast tick, or whether it should be a speech message, or something simpler with simply a statement of walk. Now, what message should be used during an extended button push that can give more information to the user? How high the volume should be? Where should the APS units be located at the corner? And what the braille text requirement should be? So a lot of these requirements are now stated in our technical specification. Now, once we develop the draft specification, we have an idea of what we want, it was time to set up a pilot project to install a few out in the field and see for ourselves how these units work, how they function, and also to decide on which product or which manufacturer of APS we want to use. Our staff had researched various brands and narrowed it down to two products, which was the Polara Navigator and the Novax DS3000. And at this point, I want to insert a little disclaimer here that we're not advocating for one manufacturer over another or against another. We're just simply stating what we chose or what we evaluated, what we chose to use as our standard. Now, for our initial pilot project, we selected 6 locations for testing. We chose locations with different geometric characteristics so that different scenarios can be evaluated. We had a couple of standard 4-legged intersection with right angle approaches, your typical for any intersection. We had one T intersection, which complicates crossing a little bit from the opposite side of the stem of the T. We had one intersection where it's a 4-legged intersection, but it had an angled crosswalk, a skewed crosswalk, which makes crossing a little more difficult than a typical intersection. And we also had 2 locations where they were mid-block crosswalks. We installed the Polara units at some of the locations, installed the Novax units at others, and we tested different settings and messages at all these different pilot locations. Now, some locations we used just the rapid tick, some locations we used just the speech message, and at others we had a combination of the fast tick followed by the speech message. And then we looked at the crossing behavior of both sight-impaired and sighted pedestrians. And we had sight-impaired pedestrians test different models to see which one was preferred. One of the interesting things that we saw was, obviously, it's beneficial to sight-impaired pedestrians. We also found that the APS units were actually helping sighted pedestrians start their crossing sooner. So that's an added bonus to having the APS. Now, from our pilot project, we did decide to use the FastTick as our standard walk indication and to use the speech message as the indication whenever whenever units are closer than 10 feet within each other. I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but this FastTick versus speech message versus other type of indication is the decision is now a moot point because in the 2009 manual, the federal manual that traffic engineers follow, the walk indication on an APS is set. It's the standard. It's FastTick for the normal situation and speech message for units that are within 10 feet of each other, which is exactly what we chose as following our pilot project. Now, from our pilot project, we also found that the buttons on the Novax units were popping off easily, which can lead to vandalism and other maintenance concerns. And the Polara units fared better in our pilot project, and we decided to use the Polara units as the city standard. Now, for jurisdictions that are starting out a program today, there are probably several other brands in the market that now compared to a few years ago when we did our product selection. So for those who are approaching their jurisdictions, they have a much wider array of choices than we did when we had a few years ago. But from our perspective, we're not actively pursuing other equipment because from a maintenance perspective, we try to stick with just one type just for the ease of learning and operating and maintaining. It's a lot harder from a maintenance perspective to stock several brands of equipment and learn different brands and how to program them. So if we were to switch to another product or use two separate products, there would have to be a major flaw in the one that we're using now, or that there's a major improvement in a competitor's product that we're looking for, but it's not offered in the ones we use. And so far we're not seeing that, and we're pretty happy with what we have right now. Now a little bit about what happened after the pilot project, which is when I started being involved. Following this initial six locations, we expanded our pilot project to seven additional locations. And this was to further test and evaluate other locations and get a better understanding of how to install these units in different locations and so forth. Now, after that pilot project came the first major widespread deployment throughout the city with the 3rd Street Light Rail project in the time frame of about 2006-2007. As part of this light rail project, we installed APS at 38 more intersections along the light rail corridor. And after the light rail project, we also had other installation opportunities also. We had a safe route to transit project where we installed APS at 13 transit stops along Market Street. As part of a signal upgrade project in the Mission District, we also installed APS at the two BART stations at 16th and Mission and 24th and Mission. City College installed two new signals in front of their campus, and we also had APS included as part of those two new signals. We also had APS installed in front of the University of San Francisco at one of their major crossings in between their two campuses at the intersection of Chabot and Turk. And as part of an in-house project where we changed the signal phasing at the intersection of Fell and Masonic to improve bicycle and pedestrian improvement, we also added APS to that intersection. And then finally, or not finally, but most recently, we completed 40 more intersections throughout the city to fulfill our promise under the settlement agreement. And like Lainey had mentioned, under the settlement agreement, we were to equip the total of 86 intersections with APS by the end of 2009. So by the end of last year, we were supposed to have 86 intersections with APS. And I'm happy to report that as of last year, we had 116 intersections with APS. That's 30 more than what we had originally planned on doing. And we're definitely not done. We still, right as we speak, we have six more locations planned or in the works. Five of these six, we applied for the federal stimulus money, and we received money to install at five locations. And the equipment's been ordered, and as soon as we receive them, we're going to schedule installation. The sixth location is a big one. It's if anyone's familiar with San Francisco, it's going to be at St. Francis Circle, and it's a nightmare to cross, even for sighted pedestrians. Muni is our public transit agency. Muni is having a rail replacement project there, and they are upgrading some of the traffic signals as well. And we are including APS as part of that replacement project. And I believe that is going to start sometime later this summer or fall. So once that project is done, we're going to be up to 122 intersections. Okay, next I'm going to talk a little bit about the design and installation and maintenance challenges that we face over these past few projects. Most of these installations were done by our own in-house staff. So our maintenance staff installed a lot of these equipment themselves. They've taken them apart. They've took them back from the field. So they're thoroughly knowledgeable about these units. And there are some that were installed as part of signal upgrade projects or new signal projects, and those were installed by contractors. But in both of those cases, we did the design ourselves before we sent it out to either the contractor or to our in-house staff to install. And some of the design challenges for installation that we face were the presence of above-ground obstructions and underground structures that prohibited pole placements at the desired locations at the corners, which is about 5 feet from the crosswalk and 5 feet from the curb. Now, with the crowded sidewalks and the presence of street furnitures, such as utility poles and trees and other immovable objects, we had to adjust our pole locations to a location as close as practical to the desired location. In suburban settings where there's not a whole lot of obstructions, you can place poles at the desired location, at the optimal location near the crossing. But in a developed and old city like San Francisco, we kind of have to work with what we've got. A lot of trees and utility poles can't be moved, and a lot of times those poles are sitting right at the optimal location where we want to install our APS. So we had to adjust for that and place it as close as practical instead of right at the optimal spot. And also, in many parts of San Francisco, we are also confronted with sub-sidewalk basements, which not a whole lot of other cities and suburbs encounter. So that was a whole new ballgame that we have to learn to deal with. Unfortunately, things like sub-sidewalk basements, their structural roof is right under the sidewalk, and we can't even dig in to build a foundation. So instead of moving the pole slightly to the left, slightly to the right to adjust for a pole, whenever we have a sub-sidewalk basement, it makes pole installation impossible. And we have to work around that by using whatever pole is available, so that since we can't install any new poles, we have to just use what we have. And we've also encountered a number of maintenance challenges as well. Having been maintaining these for a few years now, we've come across quite a few challenges, shall we say. Now, because of the limited right-of-way that we have in the city, we probably experience more pole knockdowns than any other jurisdictions because of large trucks turning the corner and jumping the curb, and as a result, they knock down a lot of our poles. That's probably something that's not seen in a whole lot of suburban cities. And when poles are knocked down, and these poles have APS units on them, replacing the APS takes on an extra dimension on our signal shop, on our maintenance staff's part. Now, if the APS unit is not damaged or just slightly damaged and can be salvaged and reinstalled on the new pole, then there's no problem. But if the APS unit is damaged, then extra care and due diligence is needed. Instead of simply putting up a spare unit like you would for a pole or a signal or a regular push button, that you just pull a spare unit from storage and put it up, with APS, the crew has to be mindful that these units are very customized, and they have to make sure that they salvage and swap out all the custom components from the damaged unit and put that on the new unit. Now, these custom components include the custom voice chip that tell them what street they're being that they're crossing, the custom sign plate that has the street name in Braille, and they also have to make sure that the replacement unit has the tactile arrow same pointed in the same direction as the original unit. And there's been a few times where the custom components on the damaged unit is not salvageable. And sometimes the whole unit has been destroyed or has gone missing. And then we would have to put up a spare unit in the meantime while we ordered the custom parts. Now, another maintenance challenge that we face is setting the volumes. When we first put in APS back in 06, 07, we had them installed and operating with the factory volume settings. And then as we received noise complaints from merchants, we lowered the volume settings accordingly. But however, as we moved into installations at locations in mixed use and residential areas, we started seeing vandalism instead of noise complaints. What happened was residents started to quote-unquote lower the volume on their own. So we've actually seen pieces of foam or pillows duct taped around the speaker. We've seen silicone and caulk around the speaker. We found hammer marks to the front of the unit, and there's been several times where it's been, you know, fairly substantial that it's actually crushed the unit and, you know, breaking off the entire circuit board, rendering them completely useless. And we've even come across places where people just break off the entire unit off the pole. So we've learned actually from other jurisdictions by going to training and seminars such as these. Our maintenance staff heard from other jurisdictions' maintenance staff, and we took a page from their book. And that was, when we install it, we are starting out with a lower volume setting at the initial installation, and then we're adjusting the volume up as low volume complaints come in. It's a little bit more work at the onset of an installation, but it sure beats having them vandalized. Now, the reasoning behind this approach is that an APS user is not going to destroy or vandalize an APS unit if the volume is too low. But for a non-APS user, they might just take it upon themselves, as we've seen time and time again, to vandalize an APS unit with too high of a volume. And also, speaking of volume, setting the right volume is almost like splitting hair. It's such a fine art. We've found over time that at a certain decibel level, you know, whether it's, you know, 50 decibel or whatever the case may be, the actual volume that's heard by the ear can differ even at the same decibel level, all depending on what the pole is like. If the speaker unit is closer to the pole or farther from the pole, that can make the sound a little different. How thick the wall of the pole is, how tall the pole is, what the pole is made out of, it actually makes the sound vibration a little bit different. So at the same volume level coming out of the APS unit speaker will sound louder or softer, depending on a whole bunch of factors. So a lot of times when we go out and set volume, We can't just simply tell the technician to set it at a certain decibel level and walk away. They have to fine-tune it, walk away, or step back, listen, and adjust it up and down again. So there's a whole lot more to volume setting than simply, you know, turning your volume up and down like you would on a car radio. Next, I would like to talk a little bit about how we handle complaints from the public. The public can call in complaints by either calling our signal shop directly or by calling our city information line, 311, which has connections to all the different departments in the city, which then forwards the complaint to our signal shop directly. Once our signal shop receives the complaint, either via 311 or directly from the public, our dispatcher will relay the information to our maintenance staff to troubleshoot and remedy. Every day we have at least one electrician assigned to handle nothing but complaint calls. Whether it's a pole knockdown, whether an intersection has gone dark because of a power failure, whether an APS unit is too loud or too soft, all those kinds of complaint calls. We have at least one person handling nothing but that. A lot of times on busier days, we pull other people off jobs to do complaints. And that's because our signal shop has a goal to arrive at a location after a complaint call within 2 hours. And our signal shop is meeting that goal about 95-96% of the time. So anytime somebody complains about an APS being too loud, we try to get out there right away before they decide that we're not coming out, I'm going to lower the volume on my own. So when we do get called out for an APS problem, if the problem is minor and relatively easy to correct, such as loose wiring or if the unit needs to be reset, then of course we make the necessary repair right there on the spot. But if damage is too severe to a point where we have to replace the unit and order custom parts, then as mentioned before, we have to put up a generic spare unit with the standard walk message and then order the replacement part as soon as possible. And if it's a volume complaint, what the shop will do is to make sure that the unit is programmed to the intended setting that engineering provides them. For some reason, sometimes the unit might reset on its own and kick itself back to a volume level that's either too high or too low than what's intended. So what the shop does first is to make sure that it is programmed, it is doing what it's supposed to do. If it is, then what the shop will do is refer the volume setting, volume adjustment request to engineering, for further evaluation.
Okay, do you have my cell phone?
All right, and next thing I would like to talk about is the requests for new installation, how the public can request new APS installations at the city, and what do we do with them after we get these requests. Now, the public can request new installations also by calling the 311 or calling our engineering office, or they can email us, or they can send us a letter to our engineering office. Once we receive the request, then we're going to evaluate the intersection and assign a score and rank it among other intersections that we've also received requests for APS. We assign points by using a prioritization tool that was based on a research project from the Transportation Research Board. And in this document, there's a companion document that has a prioritization tool in it. And this tool helps us rank an intersection based on the number of factors to determine how difficult it is for a visually impaired person to cross and the relative degree of need for APS at this location. Now, for every requested location, we will score the intersection based on the characteristics of the intersection itself and based on the difficulty of crossing at each of the crosswalks. We evaluate the intersection and assign it a point value, and we evaluate each of the 4 or 5 or 8 crosswalks in the intersection and assign each of those crosswalks a point value. And we add the intersection score to the highest crosswalk score to get the total score for that location. And this total score is what we use to rank all the different requests that we get. So based on the intersection and the crosswalk characteristics, the more difficult it is for a visually impaired person to cross, the more points it's going to get, the higher ranking it's going to be. So what kind of characteristics would receive more points? At the intersection level, we look at the configuration of the intersection, the geometrics, whether it's a typical four-legged intersection that the two streets meet at right angle. Those are typical intersections that's probably relatively the easiest ones to cross. Next comes a four-legged intersection, but two of the legs are offset from each other, so it's not just walking down the sidewalk and the crosswalk is right in front of you, because the street on the other side of this intersection is slightly offset, so the crosswalk doesn't always line up with the sidewalk, so that makes it a little more difficult. Also, we have T-intersections or five-legged intersections that make it even more complicated to cross, as well as mid-block crossings. We look at the signalization of the intersection. The easiest one to cross would be a pre-timed signal where the green and walk always comes up after the same amount of time every single cycle. So it's very predictable when you're going to get the walk if you're familiar with the intersection. There are other ways to signalize an intersection where you have to push a button to get your walk, or some of the times the pedestrian movement doesn't always go with the vehicular movement, and those are a little difficult to maneuver. It's a lot harder to judge when is it time for you to cross compared to the vehicles that are going next to you. So those would get more points. We also look at how close this intersection is to a transit facility. The more bus routes this intersection is close by, the more points it gets. We also look at the distance from this intersection to a facility that has programs for the visually impaired. And in our city's prioritization tool, we have a list of locations of facilities that have these programs. So if the closer they are to these facilities, the more points that intersection will get. Similarly, we look at public programs like libraries and so forth, how close they are to those. Other major pedestrian attractions like movie theaters, shopping centers, and the like. And in addition to looking at the intersection, we also evaluate each crosswalk. Sometimes 3 out of the 4 crosswalks at an intersection is not a problem to cross, but there could be a 4th crosswalk that makes it a lot harder to cross. So that's why from our ranking, we pick the highest scoring crosswalk to add to our intersection score to give it the total score. As far as the crosswalk goes, we look at similar characteristics where it would make crossing for the visually impaired more difficult. One of those things, obviously, is how long of a crossing it is. If it's a short crossing, the street that you're crossing is not that wide, then we get less points. But if it's a long crossing, then you get more points. We also look at the speed limit of the street that you're crossing. We look at how the crosswalk and the approach is laid out, how the geometrics is. If it's a skewed crosswalk, whether there's an island in the middle of the crosswalk, and so forth, that would make crossing a little bit more difficult. And we also look at the traffic signal control and the traffic volume on the streets. And with the traffic volume, when I first started looking at it, it seemed to be a little bit counterintuitive, where you get more points for a street that has less traffic. Yeah, from once it was explained to me, it made perfect sense. When I first started, I thought, oh, if an intersection has a lot of cars, wouldn't that make crossing against a lot of cars a lot easier or a lot harder? But from what I've heard, it makes total sense, is because the visually impaired needs to judge their crossing by the surge of when all the traffic is going. So if there's hardly any cars around, it makes it harder to cross. So that's one of the things that I've been made appreciative of, this is the continual learning that I get from the APS program. And that is probably wraps up my presentation. But before I conclude, I would like to give everyone my contact information and some other resource that you can have before you leave the program today. Again, my name is Eddie Tsui, E-D-D-I-E-T-S-U-I. My phone number is area code 415-701-4564. And my email address is eddie.tsui@sfmta.com. That's Sam, Frank, Michael, Tom, Adam. And there's also a lot of information from our agency's website, and I invite all of you to go to that, www.sfmta.com. Go on that website and click on Walk, and there you will find a link that's labeled Accessible Pedestrian Signals. Click on that, and you're going to have access to pretty much most of the information that I talked about today about APS in San Francisco. On there, you can find our request and installation policy, our prioritization tool, our technical specification, and the complete list of intersections where we currently have APS, and also the public request list. And that's all I have today. Thank you.
I just want to really compliment Eddie on his very concise and informative presentation. It's one of the best, if not the best, I have heard from a traffic engineer who's been able to talk about APSs. And Eddie and his department, or agency rather, have been very helpful, I can tell you, to Sacramento County Department of Transportation, which has been putting in signals since 1989, but facing the fact that they're going to have to give up their analog cuckoos and chirps and go with the digital technology. And Eddie has given them a lot of information, very helpful, and also how to install them. So they're there. They really want to help not just the city residents of San Francisco, but also all interested other parties. Now, yes, absolutely. Now we can ask questions. And I think there was a lady directly in front of me.
I just wanted to find out, does his company only just do San Francisco, or would he, like, for instance, come up to Southern California to, say San Diego?
I work for the city of San Francisco, so unfortunately I won't be able to travel to sunny Southern California. But I would be more than happy to, have the San Diego or whichever other jurisdiction's officials give me a call or email me or write me, and I can give them all the information I have.
Okay, thank you.
Another question?
Mr. Tsui, my name is Stephen Mendelson, and I just want to add my commendation to you and your department for your extraordinary work. I was curious to know if the city is attempting, beyond the obvious fact that this is the right thing to do from every standpoint, if they're attempting to collect any cost-benefit information over time, which would provide further justification beyond the ethical and humanitarian ones for what we're doing.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any benefit or cost benefit-cost ratios that we've been doing. I think we've been just doing a ranking, and we're going after money as they become available and install them off the request list as soon as we can.
For example, with lawsuits against the city's injury decrease
as a result, things of that nature.
I don't think we've done any of those studies of those types, unfortunately.
Next question.
Mike, yes, I'd like to know whether destroying the equipment is a hate crime. Is it a felony to destroy the equipment?
Well, I don't know if it's a hate crime or a felony, but we've had a... It's very hard to track down. You know, we've called the police, and they've told us that unless you actually
see it,
see the crime happening, I mean, it is a crime. I don't know if it's a misdemeanor or a felony, but it's a crime to damage city property.
Also, do you have unsighted people testing your going across your streets to figure out what's wrong also?
Yes, we get a lot of feedback from both the sighted and visually impaired community, and we're after we installed something, we don't walk away from it. We always get input from the public, and then whether it's good or bad, we always go back out and adjust them.
Just one quick thing. In terms of the vandalism, my understanding, and Eddie, correct me if I'm wrong, is while there has been vandalism throughout the city, there's only been a couple intersections where it's a repeated problem, maybe even just one or two. Is that? It's not like every, you know, they have 116 intersections equipped, and when we say an equipped intersection, that means both sides of every crosswalk. So there's over 1,000 APS devices actually installed in San Francisco. So in terms of repeated vandalism at locations, pretty small, isn't it?
Yeah, the vandalism is not widespread to all those intersections. They concentrate on a few. I don't know. There's definitely two locations that stick out in my mind, but I think there might be four or five that we get repeated vandalism. And one of those locations happened to be near Juvenile Hall. And we've gotten units destroyed, and we replace it, and the very next day they get destroyed again, and we were having difficulty keeping up with it. And after about a week or so, the vandalism went away. So we're suspecting that it might be one person or one group of person that was going to Juvenile Hall during that time period, and now is no longer an issue. Or that issue might come back up again a few months later. I don't know. But yes, Lainey, it is concentrated in to just a few intersections. But wherever we do see it, those intersections are kind of pretty severe.
My name is David Jackson, and I wanted to speak from the consumer's point of view. Kudos to your agency. I can't tell you how much the APS has helped me. But in terms of accessing the agency, say for example, there was an issue where I wanted an APS made louder. I had no trouble phoning the 311. They took all the information that I gave them, and it got taken care of. So it's working. I mean, that's really to do this is really wonderful from the consumer's point of view. And I think it'll only get better. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for those comments.
I don't know if this is the appropriate time in the presentation. This is Lisa Gordon. We just moved to San Leandro. All three of us are blind, and there's an intersection that me and my mobility instructor think needs an audible. It's Ashland and East 14th, and it's Caltrans-controlled intersection. I wondered if, and I understand there's been a lot of problems getting Caltrans to install audibles. My mobility instructor said they had advocated for one intersection in San Leandro, and Caltrans had said that there hadn't been enough accidents to justify it. And there's almost no near parallel for the intersection we're talking about, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that process. The mobility instructor is willing to help. She's willing to sign on to a letter. She has a form letter that she submits. So we have some help, but maybe you could talk a little bit about how we might get that to happen.
Yeah, this is Lainey. Well, one good thing is that four of the San Francisco intersections that are equipped with APS using the technical specifications are Caltrans intersections. So it's something for all, you know, the Caltrans is a big state agency with different districts. People often get a different response to requests for APS, but it's very good to know that four Caltrans intersections are equipped in San Francisco with APS. There's also, and I can, I'll send it to Donna after today, and she can put it out on the list. There is a central location in Sacramento for Caltrans to request an APS, and I would recommend that all requests go through that central location and make a reference to the fact that in San Francisco, sure, Caltrans intersections have been equipped with the most up-to-date standards.
Lisa? Yeah. Also, just follow what Lainey said, but also contact the CCB office, because we really want to keep record of that and know where they are. We need the specifics, the location, and anything like any correspondence you do. You know, and that is the thing. You put in writing or email there. CCS, and we're going to share it with Lainey, but do that. We need to have the paper trail so that if any assistance we might be able to provide the organization, that we have the background records. So,
can I call the main office?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, please.
And the mobility instructor will help. She's on board with it. She's real excited about it.
Good.
This is Donna, and I think one of the things that that we have learned in the city of Pasadena is that if you get your local traffic engineer folks to understand the issue, you know, again, those are that's a perfect ally. We were able to, you know, kind of deal with the bureaucracy in that, you know, our you know, traffic engineers in the city, once they understood the issue, you know, they were the ones who were finding the money to do our installations. And I believe we have approximately 20 intersections within the city of Pasadena that are equipped with APSs. And that was due to CCB chapter or chapters that use the city and their advocacy, and again to help the people who are working within the city, specifically the traffic engineers, to understand the issue and to understand the need. We've even been successful in having businesses, you know, we kind of go into the businesses and talk to the folks as well, which there was one intersection in the city that the APS broke, and the verbal announcement was not working. And, you know, I was so excited when I got a call from our traffic engineer, and he said, you know, Donna, there are two businesses that are by that APS that all of you have called into us that wasn't working, and even two businesses are saying, hey, you need to get that fixed. You know, you know, folks are crossing the street and they need it. So even getting the businesses on your side is great, but, you know, bring candy to your traffic engineers or whatever in the city. And, you know, they are wonderful allies once they understand the issue. Thank you.
Can we take a few more questions before we change?
Beryl Brown, Redwood Empire. You refer to a Caltrans intersection. What determines what belongs to Caltrans? I know we've run into it in Santa Rosa when we complain about a particular intersection and say, oh, well, that's Caltrans. What defines a Caltrans intersection?
Well, there are state highways that a lot of times run through local streets. So it might look like a city street, but it's assigned a state highway. So wherever those state routes are, then Caltrans has jurisdiction over them. A lot of the Caltrans intersections in the city, such as 19th Avenue, Lombard, Van Ness, even though we operate them, the city operates them, it's actually under the jurisdiction of Caltrans. So even if we, just because we want to install APS at those locations, we still have to get Caltrans's approval before we can. Fortunately, as part of Laney mentioned, we were able to get four intersections along 19th Avenue installed with APS.
That's all, Chief.
Again, thank you very much, Eddie. I really appreciate you coming this morning and giving your excellent presentation. So everyone, let's please give him a hand, and as well as Laney. It's not a morning. Okay. The next portion is, how to advocate for an accessible world and where does it all begin?
I'm going to go find Margie because she's
okay.
In here, but she was, I saw her pop her head.
Okay.
The Charles's aren't here. But
yes. And it's almost like kind of a reunion with Kim and Brian here, two of the presenters. Kim Charlson is the first vice president of the American Council of the Blind, also been active in the Bay State Council, and then even going further back, the Oregon Council of the Blind.
You don't have to go that far back, Gene. It's okay. Don't worry, I'm going further back than that tomorrow. Uh-oh.
I seem to remember Gene coming up to Oregon one time, yeah. And we had to do his laundry because his bottle of mouthwash crushed in his...
You skin. Still remember that one, don't you? Of course, I thought you were going to bring up the other story.
Well, you'll have to pay for that one.
The thing was, I just to digress, we're buying time while Margie gets here. I had organized a regional meeting of affiliates of the American Council of the Blind. The American Foundation for the Blind was helping us put together a training and advocacy, and it was placed in Sacramento. Brian is a very active person, also in the Oregon Council of the Blind, came down, and was quite a trip for him. And it was very late, and took him out to a restaurant. Do you remember this?
Is well, that where anyway, you taught me O&M crossing a 10-lane freeway?
Yeah. And so we went to a restaurant, and that was the experience of him. He had to chew so hard on the steak, he cut his gum on that one. I heard that for a while. We had some interesting things. It was really enjoyable to spend time with Brian on that whole thing. And Brian was very active in that thing. He's also on the ACB Information Access Committee. He's done some contributed on a lot of access for information in the internet. As you're going to hear, sports in a few minutes. So I guess we're kind of in a holding pattern. Please do not leave. This is going to be the training portion that we said, so you're going to have an opportunity to learn a lot more. And
five minutes late.
All right, thanks. You know, to buy a little more time, and I'm doing this without any remember of dates and things. As you may recall, 2 years ago in Sacramento, we had a presentation about destination-based elevators. And you remember that? And Jesse Lorenz was very active and still is very active in that. And the city of San Francisco wanted an ordinance on destination-based elevators because they were coming. A lot of the bigger buildings in the city were being equipped with this technology, and there's no federal or state codes for destination-based elevators. About a year ago, Walter Park from the city, in his capacity on an advisory appeals committee, and I don't have the name of the committee. Anyway, had started working with Jesse and a few other people, and they reached out to CCB, and particularly because of some things I was drafting for ACB on these elevators, and as a result, we met at a public hearing last October 14th. Bernice Kandarian, Frank Weld, Sam Chin,
Roger
Peterson, of course, and myself. Mm-hmm. We went there, gave testimony. We had gotten help prior to that meeting from Donna Pomerantz in providing information. As you know, any document's a compromise, but the ordinance, we got a lot of things in there because of the council, things that we'll present at a future convention on that. And I'm proud to say that a few weeks ago, that got adopted by the city of San Francisco. It is the only ordinance I know on destination-based elevators in the country. So it's going to become sort of the underground, under the table ordinance on destination-based elevators. And my understanding that other cities like San Jose are looking at or will be using it. The state of California is not moving on it right now, and part of it is because their hands are kind of restrained according to the Department of General Services because of a government code, and you're going to hear more about this, 4459A restricts the building code being modified to go beyond what is in the 1990 edition of the ADA for access. So we're going to have to look about repealing this section or finding it legally as unconstitutional that prohibits us from going beyond what the ADA requires, which is a minimum standard.
Gene, yes. To interrupt you for 1 second, if anybody's in San Francisco, 525 Market was my first experience with an accessible destination-based elevator. They have it installed, and it's just great. I mean, it's like, it's really, it's a great thing, and it's just a great advocacy success that CCB and the Lighthouse and AFB, everyone who's involved with this should be really proud of, because when you see it, it's like a no-brainer, like, oh my God, why isn't it always like this?
What building is that in?
It's just a big office building, 525 Market, right by the Montgomery Street BART station.
Is that one we went into, too?
It's kind of controlled. I don't know if you can...
No, it's not one of them that we went into.
Yeah, the elevator part is controlled, but I think if you went in and said, you know, show me the destination-based elevator, it's very cool. I couldn't find Margie yet. Really? However, I do know that the first part of our program was for us to introduce ourselves. Well, so we could start with Kim and Brian, if that's okay with you.
We'll do it in a second. I just want to let them know. We'll have this destination-based elevator information for you later on. There are a lot of locations or in San Francisco, and we'll try to get it, even if there's some, I think there's one in Los Angeles, try to get it to go there. You will not understand this technology until you actually try to use it. And on the keypad, the lower end, there isn't a key that you press. It's a function key for access. And as soon as you press that, it activates the voice. So that you need, and then it'll walk you through it. They don't all are identical. They're applications, so there'll be some differences, but you'll get a greater appreciation. So,
tell them what the tactile symbol is for access.
Okay, on the button, there is a tactile symbol that is a triangle, but it's made up of three dots. Three oversized braille dots that are a triangle with the apex pointed upwards. And that is a symbol that is being used on accessible pedestrian signals, letting you know that if you push that down in some cities, if you push it down, that will activate more information that tells you, like, wait to cross such and such street. It might give you other information, so access. So we'll touch upon it. And so I'm going to turn it over to Lainey and as to what to do, how to advocate for an accessible world, and where does it all begin? Lainey?
Okay.
Margie has been found.
Oh, good. I was just about to say, Margie's our leader here.
Yeah, so she's been found. She should be here probably from what Ed just told me in about 3 to 5 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe not long. So go ahead and do with the introduction.
Okay. I think we can start with the introductions. And I know when I talked to Margie about setting this up, she goes, well, let's make sure that Kim and Brian introduce themselves because we know you guys and probably a lot of people in the audience do, but maybe not everyone. So our honored guest that is I'm really happy to be up at the table with, Kim Charlson, Brian Charlson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to come back to the West Coast, where I spent most of my early years in Oregon, as many of you know, active in ACB and the Oregon affiliates. So I've been in Massachusetts a long time, but there's still a big part of me that loves to come back west. So this is a great opportunity to come to this convention. So I've been active and involved in the American Council of the Blind since I was about 14 years old when I spoke at the ACB convention in 1972. So those of you who are good at math can figure out what I'm not going to tell you. So I've been involved ever since, and since 2007 I've been honored to serve under Mitch as first vice president of the American Council of the Blind. So I've been an advocate for a long time, and what I tend to say is that the thing that really floats my boat is making system change, and I don't think there's anybody better at helping us make system change than Lainey and all the work that she's done to make it so possible for us to do so much. So it is really a pleasure to work with her. I started doing that it's been a long time, about 1999 or 2000 when I first had the opportunity. But I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. And just let me tell you that in my professional day-to-day work, I am the regional talking book librarian for the state of Massachusetts, or the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library. And I'm really happy to say that I'm not the only blind regional librarian anymore. You have one in California as well, and you should be proud of Mike Marlin and the work he does in Sacramento at the Braille and Talking Book Library in Northern California. So there's now two of us, so this is a good thing. And I'll be talking a little bit more about that with the Kahlua BRLC group over lunch, but suffice it to say, I've been active and involved in a lot of different advocacy efforts for a long, long time. So now let's see what Brian has to say.
I think you hear Margie coming, too.
Yep, and Margie's coming. We can all hear Margie coming. Many, many years. Many, many years. So let's see. Where did I get started? Let's see. There was this sweet young thing attending the Oregon School for the Blind, and And then she went on to college, and I went on to college, and I started visiting her. And that all got started because she was working at the Oregon State Legislature as an intern. And so I got involved in all of this in pursuit of all what all young men are in pursuit of. Facts is facts. And I got involved in a little group called the Oregon Alliance of Blind Students, which is where I met some fine Californians as well who shared their experience with us. Kim got me involved in the Oregon Council of the Blind through her mentor, Carol McCarl, who was then president of the Oregon Council of the Blind, and treated students very, very well, saw the value of working with young people because they were going to be the leaders of tomorrow. And I guess in this particular case, she was right. Eventually, I served on the ACB Board of Directors for 23 years, the longest anybody's been foolish enough to do that, culminating in 6 years as first vice president while Paul Edwards was president of ACB. And again, back in the day when Kim worked for the Oregon State Legislature, she didn't know that someday her future husband would also work at the Oregon State Legislature. And then, little did I know when I was ACB first vice president that someday my wife would also be ACB's first vice president. Again, this is not that that one person's following the other. We just keep tripping over one another, doing what we love to do, which is to advocate for a better world for those who are blind or visually impaired. So thank you all for inviting us to be here with you today. Hope to be able to add a few things to the panel this morning.
And Margie's here now. Yay. Your mic doesn't work, but here's Mike.
There's a table mic there.
This one.
Okay, so let me just say real quick before Margie takes us off. What we're going to do is, we're going to talk about advocacy, and we're going to leave the last 20, 25 minutes for questions. So if you can
stand right here for you.
If you can hold your questions till the end, that will be good. We're going to leave plenty of time. We're going to leave plenty of time for people to ask questions. So well, since Margie's starting, maybe I'll do my quick introduction and then take it away. So like I said before, for those of you who weren't in the room, I've been working with CCB since 1995 on advocacy efforts, and it's such an honor and privilege for this to be my work. And, you know, I've just learned so much about advocacy from working with the CCB and ACB advocates and other ACB affiliates around the country. I want to channel in my colleague and friend and partner, Linda Dardarian, who couldn't be here today but wanted to be. And it's a complete privilege for me to have the opportunity to work with Linda on these issues. I know she feels the same. For those of you who don't know, I work for myself out of my house, but Linda has a full civil rights firm behind her, and they do litigation all over the country. And while we do structured negotiations together, the fact that CCB has Linda's firm behind this effort, we think really makes a difference with the firms that end up representing the companies that we work with. So think of Linda as being here beside me. And I'll turn it over to Margie, who taught me a lot about advocacy back in 2000 when we first had a chance to work together.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm supposed to do an introduction, which is interesting when most people already know me. However, I will tell you where my advocacy roots began. It was 33 years ago at the School for the Blind. I was a student there, and I did protest. I did picketing. I got our dorm girls to do picketing and protest. We protested over popsicles being served on cold days and over serving baked beans for breakfast, and we did these petitions that went all the way up to the state. And I think my real protest there, which was more than a frivolous one like those were, my real one was when I couldn't get my eye drops. The infirmary was notorious for running out of her medication and not getting it. So I had gone home one weekend, and my parents gave me permission. We went to our local pharmacy. I had my own eye drops. And they wanted to know, after about 2 weeks, why I wasn't coming to the infirmary anymore. And I said, because I'm not going blind. And they were telling me, and at this point, I think I was 17, 18 years old, they were telling me I had to drop my medications at the infirmary or they were going to kick me out of the school.
Oh.
So I wrote a letter all the way to the State Director of Special Education, Mr. John Flores. And those are the early days of my advocacy. I've done all kinds of advocacy before Lainey was in the picture. Although I have to say, it's really great having Lainey and Linda in the picture and someone we could hand things over to. And when I get into my talk, I will talk about my more current days of advocacy. But I like to consider myself an individual who was naturally born to be an advocate. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the way we're going to structure this is we're going to talk about first sort of on a timeline, like what can and should individual advocates do to, as Kim said, bring about systems change, and at what point might it be necessary to hand it off to a lawyer? Once it's handed off to a lawyer, what is the continuing role of the advocates? Because the role of the advocates does not stop when, you know, Linda and I get involved with something or any other lawyer gets involved. True success comes from individual blind advocates and the organizations being involved through the entire process. So, you know, what is the role of the advocate before the lawyer, during the lawyer, and then once we get these, you know, agreements that CCB and other ACB affiliates, BSCB, have achieved, what is the role of the advocate in making sure those agreements work and are effective in the real world? So Marty's going to start off with the sort of where do we begin?
Great. Well, I want to tell you, I want to give a commercial right now that is an advocacy commercial, and then I'll dive into the program. But here's another example of self-advocacy. I moved to the Sacramento area about a year and a half ago, and I am a theater buff, and I was absolutely shocked with the number of blind and visually impaired individuals in the Sacramento area that there were no audio description performances in all the theaters in Sacramento. So I got a little group, including Jeff Tom, and we met with the theater, and I'm delighted and very proud to say that next Saturday, April 24th, we will have our first audio-described musical of Little House on the Prairie. So if anybody wants to take the train to Sacramento, it's very close to the train. Here's the commercial part. The tickets are $23, and there's a group of us having dinner at a very reasonably priced place just two blocks away. So just imagine, and Little House on the Prairie is not coming to the Bay Area. So this is your only chance in California to see it and see it audio described. So I'm really proud of that.
Marcia?
Yes.
There's a rumor, and I was wondering if you, that...
I love rumors.
Yeah, that at that dinner that Melissa will be coming, Gilbert will be there?
I know nothing of it.
Okay, it's a good rumor.
It is a good rumor. Maybe we'll invite her.
It would be, I think it would be.
I certainly wouldn't exclude her. I don't know how to get in touch with her. It'd be great. I can tell you for sure the audio describer will be there, who we are bringing out thanks to the Capital Chapter. We are bringing out from Nashville, Tennessee. She described it in Nashville, and we wanted someone who had previously seen the performance and audio described it. So if we can get Melissa there, that would be wonderful, too.
And it would be great, too, is, you know, where maybe that might be a place where we can all start talking about the ideas of how to advocate for the more development of these, for all live theater in Sacramento. Thank you for all your work.
That's my plan. This is a pilot, and the pilot's going well, so we're going to look at doing the next level of it. Anyway, advocacy. I like to think of advocacy as education. I think it's a real important thing. Sometimes advocacy can be adversarial, but with my personality and how much I love to jump on things, I do much better if I look at it from an educational perspective. So when you walk into, let's use a point of sales machine as an example. When I walk into a store and I find out it's a flat screen And there's nothing I can do about it, but I want to use my debit card. I start with the clerk. I say, you know, these are illegal. You really have to have a tactile pad. They're like, what do you mean a tactile pad? I say, do you have a telephone at home? Most people don't today, unfortunately, but I said, your parents had a telephone? Yeah. You know the buttons to where you can dial, where it has a one at the top left and a star at the bottom? Yeah. I said, you guys are supposed to have these attached to the machine. People are really, really interested once they grasp the concept. Well, the cashier can't do anything about it, unfortunately, but you start there. You start the educational process. Then you ask for the store manager. And they'll come over, and they'll look. You'll go through the same thing with them. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to find out that they don't even have the authority to do anything about it, unfortunately. So if you're lucky, they will send you to corporate. And there's where it really begins. Once you hit corporate, you don't know who you're dealing with. I guarantee you, you're never going to get to the corporate attorneys. And sometimes they don't send you to corporate, I'm happy to say. But once you get to corporate, it's really important to do 2 things. Always keep notes, dates, times, a synopsis of your conversation. Keep a log going. And I have a rule of thumb that the person I spoke with, I'll give them a month their first time and follow up. And I guarantee you, 9 times out of 10, you have to do the follow up because they probably dropped it. And then you just keep calling them and calling them and calling them. And like yesterday, I called, and I called Office Depot. I'm going to give you 2 scenarios as of yesterday from Office Depot and from Macy's. And at some point, somewhere down the road, you will know when it's time to then call Lainey and say, hey, Lainey, have you ever had an issue with Office Depot? Come forward. And it's important, it's critical that we establish our contact, our request, because Lainey can't send a letter to Office Depot and they go, well, no blind person's ever brought it to our attention. So we need to be the blind people out there, blind and vision impaired, that bring it to the attention of the store, of the corporation, as far as we can. And I guarantee you, there is a time to hand it over. And just before that time, as I said to Office Depot yesterday, because they have left me a voicemail and said it's in our legal department and it's an internal affair. I'm like, okay, it is not an internal affair. It impacts me as an external customer. And I really don't want to have to get into the legal arena around this, but if nothing is going to move forward, that is where we're going to go. So the next step is once I hand it over to Lainey, and you have to bug Lainey. If you want Lainey to take a case, you have to be the advocate for it, because Lainey has umpteen million other cases. And so you really have to periodically, and I'll call Lainey, and I'll call her 2-3 weeks later, say, hey, Lainey, have you considered any more on this case? And she said, yeah, we're going to get to it. And she's working on 15 other proposals. And so I'll give her a little more time, and a month later, hey, Lainey, what's ever happened with Office Depot? You know? And eventually, it's a squeaky wheel that gets the grease. It really is. And we'll throw something out there on the blind lines, if you will, and we'll find out there's other people having problem with Office Depot. So now it's just not Margie. And as we all know, one Office Depot might have a tactile point-of-sales machine, and another one may not. Once Lainey has agreed to take the case, it's vital that we discontinue all communication with that store, whether it's the local store, whether it's the corporate office. It's very important if they email us, just forward it on to Lainey, because at this point you have to put your trust in the process. And the process has become a legal process. And we could really damage that legal process. So I can't emphasize that more, that we just have to, we've done our work up to this point, we get to go on vacation, let Lainey handle it. That's how I like to think of it. And then the third step is when we are in negotiations and settlement, Lainey might be calling on us. And we need to be there as a resource for Lainey and Linda. let me not forget Linda. You know, we are the experts in blindness. Lainey and Linda are not, although they're really getting close to it. So we know what will work, and we need to think globally, way beyond myself as Margie. You have to think the whole spectrum of blind people. And for the most part, most of this stuff is routine anymore. We're not looking at what kind of buttons to put on a machine. That's very, very routine. So, and a lot of the times in that process, Lainey wants us to meet with the entity because sometimes they've never, you know, if you're dealing with corporate, they've probably never seen a blind person. And once they see a blind person and they see why these things aren't working, and we have to go through the roles frequently of demonstrating. I remember when Walmart came out and they worked with a group of us, and they're really gung-ho. They thought they had the fix. And as soon as they saw a group of blind people swiping their cards, thank God, and trying to do what we needed to do, it was a real educational process for them. It turned the channels. We had it off in a different direction. So it's vital that if you're asked to do a little traveling to get over to somewhere and do testing, that that is done so the people can see it. Now, I want to give you a contrast to Office Depot, because I'm dealing with Macy's, too. And I went there and bought my lovely jeans and wanted to use my debit card, and it was flat screen, and nobody knew what to do. And the thing I always ask for, and it can be done, is give me a hard copy printout, run it as a credit card. I will sign the paper. I will not sign on those machines. I cannot sign on those machines because the way I sign in, I use my finger as a guide. And you know, the first step you often find out is a poor cashier doesn't even know how to print out something. So I stand there very patiently. Well, it's old technology. I'm old. Remember that. It's old technology to print out. So I let them go through the process and get their manager and figure it out. As long as I get the paper in the end and I can sign on the paper in the end, and that's an interim solution. It is not a long-term fix. I also wanted to say that the bigger killer today, it kind of reminds me of the taxi discrimination industry. So we've gone from getting buttons, if you will, attachments, if you will, new machines with buttons, if you will, to some stores just thinking they've really tried their best. They've put these overlays on.
No.
And aren't they just wonderful? Rayleigh's has done that. Macy's had one. Why the staff didn't know to show it to me. But I've had a great conversation with the manager, the general manager at the store, and her voice to mail to me yesterday was extremely different. She understands why these overlays aren't working. She understands the new California laws. She was shocked and extremely apologetic that no one from Macy's has gotten back from me in their legal department. Well, I'm not shocked. Their legal department really doesn't like to talk to peons, you know, and that's again where you get the attorney involved. So, in conclusion, and wrapping up my part, I just have to really reiterate that it is advocacy, but it's advocacy with a lot of patience. It's not going to happen overnight. In my experience, the average wait time to get an accessible point-of-sales machine is about 1 to 2 years. But, you know, that's okay. That's okay, as long as we get them. Things just don't happen overnight. And we need to stay on top of it. Don't think that you've made your concerns known and it's all going to happen. You really need to stay on top of it and know that it's a process, know that it takes patience, and in the end, we will prevail, whether we go through a legal process, whether we go through structured negotiations, or whether they just choose to work with us, like my bank. My bank wouldn't work with Lainey years ago, and I came in and I started bugging them, and especially since I knew they wouldn't work with Lainey, and they finally got their ATM fixed. So thank you.
I want to I can't stress enough that all of the structured negotiation successes have been because of individual advocacy by individual CCB members starting it out. With Margie, I first got to know Margie with the Union Bank settlement, and the Union Bank lawyers told me we made our bank accessible because of Margie Donovan. They had never met a blind person, and we went down. Remember we went down there? And, you know, the Talking ATMs, the accessible website, I believe they were a sponsor of the CCB convention last year, and it was all because Margie knew how to stay firm, how to be patient, when to get the lawyers involved. And there's two other structured negotiations to my right that are just really because of the individual advocacy of Kim and Brian and other people in Massachusetts. I'll do a quick summary and turn it over to you two. You can divide it up how you want. Further back in time with Fleet Bank that ended up being bought by Bank America, it was Kim Charlson who, here's this, you know, literally internationally known person in her field, a professional who couldn't get $20 out of a bank. And the bankers at Fleet, you know, they told us we didn't understand it. You know, we didn't get that this was a problem until we met Kim Charlson. So I would say the entire Massachusetts banking industry, you know, obviously it's never one person. But Kim played a crucial role in the advocacy with the Massachusetts banking industry, as well as other things. The Major League Baseball web accessibility settlement, which is another one of my favorites, really, Brian Charlson, you cannot imagine how much work Brian has and continues to do to make sure Major League Baseball website and the players are accessible to every blind person in this country.
Yeah.
Really, I mean,
yes. It's just...
You know, in Brian's advocacy, it was the perfect, you know, like Margie was saying, that the blind community in Massachusetts really tried to do this, you know, without lawyers, had detailed records of what they had tried to do. So at the time where it was necessary to bring lawyers in, it made our job not just easy but possible. So turn it over to Kim and Brian to talk about that.
Thanks, Lainey. You know, it only takes one time going to an ATM and, you know, before they talked and punching in the magic sequence that you memorized and getting stamps instead of money to really make you mad. And that's what happened to me. I said, oops, I must have done something wrong. So I did it again. My little memorized pattern, you know, out came $5 more worth of stamps. I said, something is wrong. And I literally had to ask the person in line behind me what had happened, and it was the software update of the weekend. Press 1 for English, 2 for Spanish. I didn't know, so I kept getting stamps. I said, this is crazy. This can't go on. The banking industry has got to be able to make these ATMs accessible, and I'm going to do something about it. And through the auspices of Bay State Council and the Disability Law Center in Boston, that then connected with Lainey, we did advocate to get Fleet Bank, which is now Bank of America, to install ATMs, and we had great success. And the one thing that Lainey said about, you know, you kind of have to keep following up and following up on all these. Well, we settled our ATM case in, I think it was in 2001, and there was a whole schedule for rollout of the Talking ATMs over the next 4 or 5 years. But, you know, because I was so involved then, I'm still pretty involved now because everybody knows how involved I was. And so whenever there's an ATM that isn't talking or a bank statement that's late, they call me and they say, did you know my ATM isn't working? What should we do? So, you know, I have the phone numbers to vice presidents at Bank of America who nobody else could have those numbers because I know who to call because of the advocacy. And when I call those folks or I let Lainey know there's a problem, it gets fixed so quickly. They can't do it quick enough. So, you know, sometimes you still keep being involved. But that's also a way to monitor the success of what you've done. Is, you know, if you don't hear from people very often, you can assume things are going fairly well. So I've had the opportunity to work on several other structured negotiation settlements. One was with CVS Pharmacy. We did a lot of work. I worked with Lainey on training. I've done quite a bit on my areas of expertise with Lainey are accessible formats production, so that's getting you accessible materials, how to produce those materials, training, and Braille standards. Those are my areas where I really hope I contribute to the process. And CVS was a huge training issue because at the time it was the templates on the touchscreen point-of-sale devices. Staples also, another settlement that we had that involved point-of-sale, and the headquarters of Staples is in Massachusetts. So we thought that Bay State Council, again, was a good fit for that negotiation with others, I think CCB?
Mm-hmm.
CCB and ACB as well. I also worked with Lainey on one that was near and dear to my heart because everybody has the right to their credit report.
Oh, yes.
And thanks to Lainey and all the work that she's done, you know, we have access to our credit reports in an accessible format just like everyone else in the United States can get now today because of the work of Lainey and Linda.
Yes.
And the groups that started that. So that is huge. That is huge. And, you know, every one of you can call the 800 number, get your credit report. I just refinanced my house a few months ago, and I got my credit report before to make sure everything was all neat and tidy. There wasn't going to be any surprises, and it worked great. So today I'm having the opportunity to work with Lainey and a crew from ACB, CCB, the ACB Health Issues Task Force on a settlement that's in process now with the American Cancer Society to make sure that we get accessible information from organizations. So that's been an area where I've been able to help. And I think, you know, these are all areas that touch people's lives every day. And we're making a huge impact on making this, you know, our society and our country a more accessible place for people who are blind and visually impaired. But it isn't all about work and everything. It's also about fun.
Yeah.
And fun is pretty important. And, you know, I can't think of any more important guy in having fun than Brian when it comes to baseball. And I'll let him tell you his story.
As I said during introductions, I was on ACB's board for 23 years. I get involved in Major League Baseball for 12 months, and man, I'm Mr. Baseball. I couldn't achieve that in politics. Well, there you go. Anyway, I want to tell you a little bit about what it takes to be an advocate, and the first and foremost thing is a passion for your subject. Maybe your passion is shopping, like Margie down there. By the way, I've never heard of jeans as being lovely. Sexy, yeah. Lovely? I don't know. Anyway, but shopping.
They are, Brian.
Shopping is something that people can be very passionate about and want to be able to do independently. And if that's your passion, that's where we need you, you know, to get on board and become an advocate. If your passion is banking and, you know, you're the kind of person who gets that bank statement and really wants to reconcile it and do all those lovely number things, then that's what you should bring to the party,
mm-hmm.
what your passion is. It so happens that when I moved from Oregon out to Massachusetts, I was in desperate need of something to say to bus drivers and taxi drivers so they think of me as an individual and not just another fare. And so I got to know that what they really liked a lot in Massachusetts was a little team called the Red Sox.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I said, you know, Oregon is not noted as a baseball state.
No, it's not.
Okay. So I had no idea about this thing. So I started reading up on it, listening to a few games, being able to drop a name, drop a score, drop a famous event in Red Sox history, and suddenly all the bus drivers and taxi drivers were my buddy. And that worked really well. But, you know, once you get started down that road, you get the bug. And so I started going to games, and a friend of mine started inviting me to share his season tickets. Mind you, not for free, but nonetheless, season tickets. And I got to go to some Red Sox games and got to, in the process of that, deal with issues of advocacy. For me, it started out the advocacy of being able to bring my guide dog to a ball game. Now, you guys don't know this probably, but Fenway Park, where the Red Sox play, have the smallest seats in all of baseball. And there is simply no place to put a guide dog there. But they had an arrangement with the wheelchair-using public that they could have special seating where it was a fold-out chair and plenty of room around you, et cetera, et cetera. And they would not, at the beginning, let a guide dog user take advantage of the same space. So it came time to do a little advocacy. So in talking with the Red Sox people, we eventually got them to do a number of great things for us as an individual team. Then a friend of mine, Rick Morin, and I decided we were going to have a baseball vacation. And we did eight games in six cities in 8 days. Well, and it was a great time. I got to go online and book my my Amtrak tickets for city to city and my hotel arrangements and buy my tickets. And I realized that a lot of what makes baseball fun in the modern age is being able to look things up online. Mm-hmm. Baseball is first and foremost a game of numbers, batting averages, speeds, all of that kind of stuff. And when I went to MLB.com and tried to find anything out, you know, it was like throwing dice. It was just random numbers. I couldn't follow any of it. When I wanted to book tickets for a game, well, that part just suddenly was totally inaccessible to me. So we started talking to people, and of course, with my wife's experience with Lainey and the whole process of structured negotiation, we said maybe this is something, since it's nationwide, since we have other baseball fans I know who are blind or visually impaired who are probably experiencing the same level of frustration, let's take this to structured negotiation. Now, we had the history of working with the Red Sox. So when we came to Lainey and Linda, it was not without some history and some effort and some friend making. People talk about fundraising a lot. Let me tell you, a lot of what makes the world work is friendraising, mm-hmm. not fundraising. Mm-hmm. So we had the contacts, and we could turn those contacts over to Lainey, and she could start to use them. So now we're on first names with that corporate lawyer, Mitch. I thought that was kind of funny, you know, Mitch and Mitch. Anyway, Mitch. And we always have to say, you know, Mitch the MLB Mitch, the ACB Mitch, right? And we worked it out, and we were able to start getting their attention. Quite honestly, though, don't let them hear this, without all that much of a legal leg to stand on. We said, we think you should do this because it's the right thing. We think you should do this because it's good business. Mm-hmm. Believe me, they're not giving me the ticket to the ball game.
Right.
going to Fenway is the most expensive baseball experience, again, in all of baseball. Smallest seat, biggest prices. And so they know that it's good business. We love our Red Sox, and we'll spend our dollars to go and all the memorabilia, et cetera. So we got their attention in that regard. And we started talking about how we could make the baseball experience a good one for us and a good one for MLB. We'd bring up an idea, and it wasn't a month or two later that we heard something. It was a day or two later, or at the most a week or two later, that they started getting things. The last round that we've been involved with, I'm talking to the programmer who is writing the audio player for MLB's website, as well as working with the team. And I was trying to do this while others were talking, but my iPhone suddenly decided to have jet lag, so it's not working at this moment. Anyways, you brought up At-Bat. Anybody use At-Bat yet?
Mm-mm.
At-Bat is an application you can put on your iPhone, one of those lovely apps, and allows you to not only listen to the game today, but listen to yesterday's game. And if you pay the right price for video, you can get the video of the game, so you can watch the ball game on your iPhone. You can also, however, with At-Bat, get ongoing statistics during the game.
Oh, wow.
You can ask it, who's at bat? What's the current count? What's the nature of the pitches the current pitcher is throwing?
Right.
You can do all of those kinds of things on the fly. While I was waiting to catch my plane here, I pulled out my iPhone because I'd missed the game and said, okay, so what's up? Went to at bat, they brought up the stats, and I learned then that a good old Well, the Red Sox hadn't done so well. They lost 8-0 to Minnesota.
Oh.
So it wasn't a pretty thing to find out. But nonetheless, I was able to do that while standing in line. That was pretty cool. Again, this application at the opening of the season had taken a major step backwards. Some of the upgrades, and then we find this always with access technology. What to some people is an upgrade is for us an accessibility downgrade. It worked last season, don't work this season, that kind of thing. So literally our lawyer over at MLB, Mitch, was in an elevator and overheard an elevator conversation of the team that was working on the at-bat application for the iPhone. And they were saying, without him saying anything, don't forget we've got to work on accessibility with this as well.
Oh, awesome.
So it becomes viral inside the company as well. So pick something you're passionate about.
Yes.
Not something that you know you're interested today, but tomorrow you've got other fish to fry. Pick something you're passionate about and become its champion and bring along with you friends with a similar passion and professionals with a similar passion like Linda and Lainey. Thank you.
Very good.
Let me thank you, Brian and Kim.
Yes.
I already channeled Linda into the room. I also want to just channel a few people who are in the room up at the up to the table. You know, Steve Mendelson is sitting in the front row, the earliest, maybe the first talking ATM champion in the country,
mm-hmm.
and the Citibank, which was a hard nut to crack, talking ATMs. Like everything else, it's never one individual, but there is never just one individual, but there always is one individual. And Steve Mendelson was that individual for Citibank, which led to all the other talking ATM successes in the country. Donna here in the front. Well, that sort of goes to, Steve said we should mention Barry. That goes to Brian's idea of friend raising, mm-hmm. not just fundraising. Steve is friends with one of Linda's partners and was talking to that partner. That partner knew that I had been working on disability rights issues. We got Linda involved. Linda and I, the rest is history. So that's for fundraising. Donna in the front row here has really been instrumental in a lot of the structured negotiations. You know, when I say, or when a company says, oh, we'd like to test this device or this ATM, Donna has just an incredible understanding that testing for the blind community is not bringing one person. You know, you have to... When you're an advocate, you're not just for yourself, you're for every blind and visually impaired person. Individuals have different needs. You know, there's a million different ways of putting together a testing group, and Dawn has really been instrumental in understanding that and getting really strong groups to give the kind of feedback companies need to hear to make this stuff work. And I'd be remiss without another front row person here, who is Jeff Tom. You're California Council of the Blind. You know, now it seems like, oh, structured negotiations, that's a good way to do things. It took the vision and confidence and trust of the leadership of this organization early on when we didn't have the track record we have now. Mitch was the first CCB president when we got involved in asking for trust in this process. It isn't litigation. Kathy Skivers was an incredible champion, and now for the past however many years, you know, Jeff has just been so supportive of the process. And you know, it doesn't just happen. The agreements don't just show up on my website. It starts with all these kinds of things. One other person I want to bring into the room, when Margie said you have to bug me and Linda, that is really true. And the credit report settlement, which is another one of my favorites and something that CCB and ACB should really be so proud of, because that is a system with three major credit reporting agencies in the country, is pretty seamless now. I mean, you call that 800 number and, you know, press 3 for Braille, press 4 for large print, and it's just like right there as part of the system integrated. Started with a Massachusetts advocate named Paul Paravano, and he had to keep bugging me. Lainey, I really think, you know, way before the credit reports were even free in the United States, he had read that they were going to be free and was concerned that they wouldn't be accessible. And so I'm not really inviting everyone to bug me, but you need to be an advocate
but
with your colleagues.
How many of you know the 800 number? Maybe not off the top of your head, but how about if I tell you? Because, see, I'm a librarian.
That's
I never go anywhere without my resources. So 877-322-8222.
228 is the number to call for your free credit report.
One more time?
877-322-8228.
Having been a class that's gotten the credit report into the system.
That brings up a very, very important issue to discuss here. We can work all we want to make things accessible. And I know that it's a transition. I know if it's something that has never occurred to us in our life, such as a credit report. And I remember this being the case when the first talking ATMs came out. What we kept hearing from the bank is blind people aren't using them. So it's really important that we begin to use the things that are becoming accessible. Even if you don't have any, you know, you're not going to go buy a house, so you don't really have any reason, but everybody has a reason today with identity fraud. Everybody should be checking their credit reports. Now, I'll give you a little hint that I just learned. Last year and this year both, I got all three credit reports at once. Don't do it. Don't do it. It's overwhelming. Probably, you know, about a quarter apart or thereabouts. It also is good to spread the time out because, you know, you see different things in your credit report different times a year. Now, I want to jump in and just tell another little self-advocacy story that happened recently. And I had every reason in the world to be very emotional about this. And I think being emotional is not the way to go. I like to call anger, frustration as emotional. I just bought a house and I was in the escrow office, thank you, signing all of my documents. My agent was there, her husband was there, my lender was there. And all of a sudden, the escrow officer says, we need witnesses.
Yeah.
And so my agent's husband, Bob, who had been working with us through the process, and my partner, RC, started signing these witness papers. And I just let it go through. I mean, I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize this house. I pull out my cell phone. I call Mitch. I said, Mitch, am I correct that this should not be happening? And Mitch says, yeah. And I looked at this woman. I said, I'm going to tell you something. What you are doing is absolutely illegal. I said, now, I'm not going to stop this process because I want this house. I said, but if these papers go through, I absolutely guarantee you there will be some legal action. So then she and my agent, who was absolutely phenomenal, she got in there and she knew that I didn't want this from the beginning. And it ended up being the title company we were working with was a title company that we were going to work with on a previous closure, and it's the parent title company. So Nora is telling this lady that, well, if the parent title company doesn't require it, why are you? And I just walked out of there. I said, I'm going to follow up on this legally. And if this needs to be done, well, within 24 hours, I had the whole packet of witness forms at FedEx back to me. And that was a situation where I wanted to get very emotional about it. You know, buying a house is an emotional process, mm-hmm. and putting out that much money, and now they're discriminating against you. So, again, that's the reason why you just have to take a breath. You have to stand your ground. You have to let them know, you know, I'm going to do this, but it's illegal, and you will hear from me afterwards. So I didn't have to do it. I got the papers back. I happily shred them, and I'm a proud indebtor today.
Okay, we thought that we should just do a quick, really quick overview of the types of advocacy California Council of the Blind is working on in structured negotiations. Of course, you know, structured negotiations is not the only legal advocacy method, so I just want to say a word in recognition of the work that DREDF did in the litigation with Social Security Administration. I understand the DREDF people are going to be here tomorrow. So structured negotiations has not been used with the federal government, and there are various issues why not, but the success that DREDF had with Social Security Administration, the alternative formats, is just, you know, if you're dealing with a federal issue or getting information from a federal agency, when you've done your individual advocacy and it's time to look at a lawyer, that lawyer would be Dredef because of the success they had with Social Security Administration. So in terms of the advocacy that CCB, just really quick, is working on now, a couple things I wanted to mention. One, audio description in movies. Again, yeah. That, again, you know, it's never one individual, but it's always one individual. And in addition to California Council of the Blind, I don't know how many of you know Helen Popper and her daughter Rio, who were referred to us by Margie. Rio is a blind girl who I think is like 9 now.
Yes, she is.
And her mom is sighted. She's an incredible advocate for her daughter. Rio's an incredible, I'm telling you right now today, the girl is 9. She's going to be a civil rights lawyer when she grows up. I mean, this girl is like on it. And, you know, going to movies is important for her, not just to go to movies as a little girl, but to be part of the community. And, you know, she's, of course, in an integrated classroom. So the one theater we're starting our focus on is Cinemark in Northern California that has no audio description. So I'll just say what these things are. People can come up to me after if they have individual experience with any of these entities. We can talk more about it. California Council of the Blind, through the point of sale effort, has very strong relationships with a lot of national retail pharmacy chains. We have point of sale agreements with CVS, with Walmart, with Target, with a lot of entities that have pharmacy chains. And through those relationships, we are working with those entities, trying to work with those entities on the issue of accessible prescription information, which, just like financial information that now seems, oh yeah, of course, people should have financial information accessible format, same thing with prescription information. So it's an effort that the California Council of the Blind, working with American Council of the Blind and the AFB, are working on with a lot of different national retail pharmacy chains. Airline kiosks, another thing that I think we'll look back one day and say, how could those things not have been accessible? But right now they're not. So our first airline that we're trying to talk to about that is JetBlue. If anybody has personal experience with that, they can come up to me afterwards, as well as the JetBlue website. Structured negotiations has been used with, I think, 12 or 13 agreements on accessible websites. And if, you know, another example where individual advocacy can really matter, you go on a website, you can't register, there's a visual CAPTCHA, you can't get the information you need, you got to follow Brian's advice. And if you're passionate about that, you have a right to the information on that website. Healthcare information, again, like financial information, everything that you need about your health care, you know, insurance documents and like the American Cancer Society information, that information should all be accessible. And we're hoping to work with Blue Cross, Anthem Blue Cross, as a company that should be providing accessible healthcare information online, as well as in Braille, large print, and audio. If anyone has any personal experiences with that, they can come up to me. We continue to work on financial issues. We have a call from a woman who spends a lot of time on the Charles Schwab website, which, again, things, if we don't stay on top of it, can go from good to bad, as well as good to better. So Charles Schwab was a website that was more accessible, is now less accessible. Anyone with experience on that can come and talk to me. And finally, the Major League Baseball success has led to an interest in making sure other sporting sites, especially the larger ones like NFL, CBS College Sports, are accessible. So if that's an issue that you're passionate about, to use Brian's term, you should talk to me about that as well. So if the table doesn't have Anything else to add? We could open it up for questions.
I do want to add one thing that I think is in your documentation, when you find the right advocacy that you want to work on to make this world a better place and more accessible, certainly if it has to do with a store and you continue to go there, save your receipts. It is very important to prove each and every time you went there when it gets into the legal process. So remember that. Just make a file and throw them in there.
Another thing, too, that we can help you with, one of the things that, and I think it was mentioned, although I missed a little bit of it, one of the things that we try to do is to have people write to the entity that they're having problems with before any negotiations are entered into to see whether
Absolutely.
You can get a result. Now, we can help you. If you don't feel like you know how to write the correct letter, just call either Lainey or call me. We can draft the letter in your name and see what kind of result we can get. So, because some people feel a little bit frightened of the whole system of trying to write that letter. And that's something we can certainly help you with.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah, I would say in almost every single time we have our first conversation with a lawyer, even with the best companies, we end up in great relationships with, like MLB. The first thing we hear is, oh, you should have had your people contact us. So we have to be able to say, quote unquote, our people, you know, did contact you. I mean, every single company, oh, if only the council had written, we never heard from a blind person. So we need to be able to say, yes, you did, and here's who, and here's when, and here's a response they get. And that is the key thing between someone slamming the door in our face and someone saying, oh, yeah, we want to work with you, and we see why a legal system is necessary here.
Yeah. So at this point, we thought it would be really great, because part of learning to advocate is bringing your questions and concerns forward, and we would entertain questions at this point from the audience. Stand up and they'll get you a mic, please.
Hi, Lisa Gordon. We are trying to get Sirius internet radio. We can't access our radio won't connect, so we're trying to do it on the internet. And I just created the free trial just to make sure that it worked. And there's a CAPTCHA, no audio CAPTCHA, no math problem to do instead, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any advice?
Brian, do you want to...
There's no doubt some part of that site, and I haven't done it yet. I'm with the other company, XM, which is all now one company, I guess. So it's all depends on which door you walked into. Anyway, there's undoubtedly a component there where one can send email to the company. Almost all e-commerce sites have some means not to call somebody. They kind of hide the phone number pretty well. But they usually leave open some way to send, you know, info at whatever kind of website. I highly recommend you make that contact through that method. The other thing is, if you can get a little bit of assistance from a sighted friend to find out what the nature of the standard CAPTCHA is... Most of the audio CAPTCHA that's out there is actually a variant of the print CAPTCHA that goes with it. And we could make contact with that company to make sure that they act as our advocate. Because there's although there's a little bit of business involved, mostly it's somebody chose not to go to the bother of the audio CAPTCHA side.
Right.
It's there. It's almost no expense at all to the company that uses it. Because I don't know if you've noticed the nature of audio CAPTCHAs. Mm. What is the content?
Random.
No, it's not random.
I know.
It is snippets of old-time radio.
Oh, is it really?
Snippets of old-time radio. And what they're doing is they're taking what you write in as your CAPTCHA, and they're slowly developing transcripts of old-time radio shows through your writing in the CAPTCHAs. So there's a business model behind that, and that company would love to find a way to get their audio CAPTCHA on there so that they can get even more people helping them transcribe audio content.
Let me say something about the CAPTCHA that Brian's comments are triggering me. It's really important when faced with an audio captcha, to listen to the instructions, because the main type of audio captcha right now is by a company called ReCAPTCHA that was purchased by Google last year. And like Brian said, the business model is capturing these snippets, and the directions say, do the best you can. Don't worry if you don't get every word. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing to say about the audio capture. I would agree with Brian that you need to, hopefully there's an accessible way to contact the company. And that's what you need to do with that. I also forgot to mention before, and I want to mention now, that you know, I have a website, and the URL for the website is LF, my initials, LFlegal.com. And all the California Council of the Blind settlements and press releases are up there, and there's a lot of other information. Like, for example, when Google purchased ReCAPTCHA, I did a post about that, and I think I have the contact information. The guy who developed the audio captcha is a guy named Louis Von Ahn, and he's like totally, or he was before Google bought him, I don't know now, you know, totally available to take the feedback. And it's surprising how small this world is kind of behind I mean, Brian didn't give justice to the work he's doing with this developer at MLB. It's not like Brian just talked to the guy once. It's like the guy is constantly available to us.
Good old Kyle. Yeah, he's doing great things. And it's also good if the person who's interacting with people knows a little bit about what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you that having some background in the field of web accessibility and being involved in that conversation, I'm not just saying, it doesn't work. I'm saying, you go down to this link on this page. I've done it 5 times, so I've replicated it. It wasn't a one-time anomaly. I did it 5 different times, and in those 5 different times, I came up with the same result, and it's not a good one. You know, you get their attention by being a specialist. Kim mentioned something here I wanted to mention to you as well. I'm very concerned, as I think anybody who advocates in the field of access technology is concerned, that it's possible to do things, but sometimes it's insane what you're asked to do,
right,
to do those things.
Yep.
It's the fancy term is cognitive load. When you have to have a doctorate in what it is you're doing to do something the sighted guy does with a point and click, there's something wrong with the system.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are ways to get around text only captures, things like Celona. There's another one whose name escapes me. That WebVism, that you have to use Firefox to do, but Celona you can use either system. And it allows you to take a picture of the print captcha, send it to somebody out there in the Ethernet who is sitting there saying, I've got nothing to do with my coffee break, I'll simply solve a captcha for somebody. They type it in, and it comes back at you, and you type it in or cut and paste it in. It's a great idea workaround. The fact of the matter, though, is it is a workaround that requires that you install something on your system, that somebody's on a caffeine high out there has nothing better to do than to solve your captchas for you, and those kinds of things. So it's better to advocate for audio captcha than it is to use the workaround. Even when something is, there's a quick way for you to fix it, stop and think, how would this work if it were my friend who's not so computer savvy as me? And ask whether that needs a bit of advocacy to make it happen.
I want to jump in and say, let's remember that first communication where you link into an email to the company from their website is your first communication with that company, and you should be CCing yourself on it so you can save it. Don't ever forget that any and all communications you need to have track record of. Document. Are there other questions?
I was asked to spell a couple of things I mentioned. So Celona, S-O-L-N-A, Celona dot I believe it's .com.
Is that Firefox?
S-A-L-O-N-A. That's one we'll work on both Firefox and Internet Explorer. And the one that works only on Firefox, and quite honestly, those, you know, I've got friends who love Firefox, and so they get very passionate that this is better. I don't know it's better. It's different. And that's WebVism. W-E-B-V-I-S-M. WebVism.
I think it has a U.
Is it U-M? See, I told Kim to spell it. I told her I couldn't spell my way out of a wet paper bag.
The comment a moment ago about the inaccessibility of web-based Sirius.
Who's speaking?
Oh, Steve Mendelson. Sorry, Margie. The comment about inaccessibility of web-based Sirius or XM brings us back to the question implicated in all our discussion of point-of-sale machines and ATMs, and that is the question of hardware accessibility. And I think that is the next big frontier, because most issues of website accessibility and most software-based problems can, to some degree, at least conceptually, be solved. They may not be practically that easily soluble, and the bureaucracy involved in solving them or the legal issues involved in solving them may be complex, but conceptually, I think we have a pretty good idea about them. When it comes to the hardware-based issues, which are becoming increasingly frustrating in the advocacy context for a variety of reasons, they seem to involve a number of different calculuses, and I wonder if the panel would like to talk to some of them for a minute.
Are you thinking about something in particular you want to throw out as a...
XM, okay. So when you want to listen to satellite radio, if you're going to do XM, if you're going to do Sirius, you're going to have to use a receiver that's capable of that.
And those are all, to some degree, inaccessible.
And those, in fact, what ends up happening, you know, when somebody says, it's accessible, you've got to really, you know, inform that there's almost nothing in this world that's 100% accessible. There are parts of it. I use XM every day. I can pick my channel. I can listen all I'd like. However, the record functions of my XM receiver, so I could program it to record a given show at a given time so I could listen to it later, is fully inaccessible to me. So again, yes, there is the hardware issues, and they are harder ones to crack because it's not just a matter of changing a line of code. There's a built infrastructure out there that makes up part of that. To me, the biggest one is not XM or Sirius, although I'm an avid user of the service, set-top boxes.
Oh, yes.
There is a hardware solution available now. The question is the advocacy or legal basis for enforcing its use.
To force them to use an accessible thing. I was over at the CSUN conference down in San Diego a couple of 3 weeks ago, and RNIB, Royal National Institute of the Blind, was there demonstrating an accessible set-top box.
Oh, wow.
And it's certainly possible. Now, did I say it's fully accessible? Unless you ever hear the words fully out of me, I don't mean fully. There are parts of what happens on a set-top box that it doesn't voice at this time. But you could turn on and off audio description independently with this set-top box. You could record what you wanted to record in a DVR kind of environment.
Oh, really?
With this set-top box. You can channel through and access the information about what the program is you're watching at this moment. But the channel guide that gives you the ability to see what's going to be on in a half hour on this channel, apparently that's the part that doesn't work currently. But nonetheless, we need to advocate for hardware accessibility as well as software accessibility in this whole scenario.
Just to follow up to that, and I think Steve was just about to say this, which is the set-top boxes is a really perfect example of why we need H.R. 3101, the Telecommunications
yes.
Video
yes.
Description
yes.
Accessibility Act, because there's no mandate for these companies to do anything to make anything for us accessible. They don't really care. I mean,
that's
maybe
right.
A few people do, you know, but I mean, I have to give a lot of credit to Eric Bridges and the work that he's doing with the FCC and the Consumer Industry Subcommittee of the Consumer Advisory Committee that he's on with the FCC, because he's the only blind guy on that committee. He says, I'm sitting in the room with these people from Verizon and every other industry, and they're talking things I don't understand, but all I have to say is it doesn't work, and they're going, Eric, what do we do? You know, they're listening to him. And, you know, the mandate, we've got to get that mandate back. So, you know, keep up the great work here in California. We need 3101 desperately to get that accessibility and to get video description working again on television.
Yes.
I mean, you know, if you're an advocate and you like to watch NCIS with video description, you may be having a real hard time like I am in Massachusetts. I can't get the description because of the digital conversion and the hardware and software issues with all the channels and the networks. And there's always something going on. And I haven't had description on my TV for almost a year. And I've been sending emails to industry folks. I'm about to launch my latest barrage when I get back because it's been about 6 weeks since anybody answered any of my questions. Where's my description? And they keep telling me it's coming. We're working on it. We're working on it. Well, I don't think I should have to wait a year to watch NCIS with description when I know it's out there with description. So a perfect example of something that you possibly might be passionate about, which is, you know, your favorite television show. So.
And let me tell you, she is passionate about that show. I have missed the opening act on American Idol. Everyone. Because we first have to see if NCIS is being described tonight before I'm allowed to see it. So I don't get to see it the first time.
So he's advocating against me getting my
No, okay. Well, there's more than one television in the house. You go to the other one. But I do think, though, that we have to do two things. There's almost never the answer. There's almost always several different ways to do something. We need not to stop trying to convince business that doing business with the blind is good business.
Yeah.
You heard Margie talk about when they saw people swiping their cards at Walmart. And people didn't just see things, they heard ching, ching, ching. That does persuade some folks who would otherwise be hard to bring to the party. So we have to continue to show that, in fact, doing business with the blind is good business.
Someone has the mic.
Go ahead.
I have a question. I'm Linda Fonseca. I'm trying to teach myself guitar. You know, maybe Mr. Baseball, computer savvy. Do you know any websites where I can go to teach myself guitar with lessons, you know, cost of lessons going skyrocketing? You know where I could go?
While this might have, yeah, there's the music section at NLS that can get you material in recorded form for free. That's always a good term. There's something called Talking Tabs, which is guitar lessons on CD by a blind musician, and he teaches you everything. He's very capable of it, but you have to buy the lessons. I understand that.
Yeah, I have to buy them.
NLS has them now on Borrow, so you might want to ask about Talking Tabs from NLS.
Can I just ask, this actually is a bit off topic.
Right, I was about to say the last thing, and that is part of what we need to do is to continually be educated about what's going on out there, because you can say it's inaccessible, but when you say it's inaccessible and you're talking about a whole industry and not a specific site, you had better be able to document where you've gone that it's inaccessible.
Right.
And a great place to keep educated is a little thing called Fred's Head, which is a post out of American Printing House for the Blind. And they just had a piece a few weeks ago about accessible guitar stuff, and that's what brings it to mind. But it's a good example of we need to be educated consumers,
yes,
not ignorant consumers, if we're going to be advocates.
This is off topic, but for Linda, the website, it will...
Can you speak into the mic, please?
How's that?
Much better.
Cool.
And your name?
My name is Therese. There is a website called musicfortheblind.com, and you can either download or purchase tapes or CDs on various instruments for you to learn, but it will cost you some money. But very accessible website.
Okay, we're going to take a few more questions. Before we do, there's one part of advocacy that hasn't been mentioned I want to throw out before I forget, which is if a company or a website is doing something right, you need to tell them. That is part of advocacy, too. I cannot tell you how much a big corporation like Bank of America, like one little email saying, I appreciate your talking ATMs. They circulate it. They like it. You know, for people listening on the Internet, companies like getting awards. You know, they like being recognized in the branches, up to corporate, on the website, emails. That is part of advocacy. Like Brian said, letting them know there is a blind community out there that appreciates, wants, needs, and values the accessibility features. So don't forget about the positive part of it as well.
And remember, with that being said, that internally in the CCB, we do have an awards committee, and you can nominate an entity such as Bank of America or whomever for a CCB Access Award.
We gave them all awards already.
Yeah, well, I just used Bank of America. There's plenty of them out there.
Hello. Yeah. And I want to echo the fine work that Lainey and Margie have done. And a lot of people don't know all Margie's work with the veterans accessibility issue. And she brought that all the way to the faces of the, in the faces of the legislature, I should say. So that stirred up an audit, and they audited the Veterans Affairs. But I want to give kudos and start getting the ball rolling to give Golden One an award. Golden One is a bank in Sacramento, and their website is probably one of the most accessible websites I've ever been on, period. I can access every aspect of my bank account, transfer funds. I can do it on my mobile phone. I can do it on my Braille note. They are just really, I have nothing but good things to say about them, and they did it voluntarily on their own. So
Not quite.
Well,
not quite.
But they did not go through structured negotiations. So
all right. Well, you know, let me just say one quick thing about that. The California Council of the Blind wrote a letter to Golden One, asked them to engage in structured negotiations. I spent probably 9 months of time working with them. We had, you know, draft agreement language, and at the end of the day, unlike a lot of these companies, they chose not to sign an agreement and be recognized as a partner in the process. However, they did do the right thing. And it's wonderful that they have talking ATMs in accessible websites and Braille information, but in that situation, we don't have, you know, a structured negotiation settlement up on the website, but without the advocacy of California Council of the Blind and all the work the Golden One team did with them, I would think it wouldn't be quite as good as it is today.
Right. And as a Golden One customer, myself, when I moved to Folsom, I documented a lot of incidences where their talking ATM wasn't working. Until I started getting nasty with them about this not being acceptable, they'd make sure it works, but then they didn't make sure it works when I walked away. So every time I came back, it didn't work. I do think, now this is not to say they have not put forth an effort, and I agree with you, Dan. It doesn't have to be perfect, but because they really, at least my branches, put forth a great effort after they learned who I was. They don't want me going in anymore, but maybe you and I can work on a letter of nomination for next spring.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, we haven't received a letter.
Hello, this is Glenda Castle from San Diego. As far as the
can you put the mic?
As far as the music thing that Linda Benteco was asking about, there's a gentleman called Bill Brown, and he teaches music. How to play different instruments and things. And if you contact me later, I can give you that information. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask, I believe it's Lainey, what about different sites like IRS and so on and such? When are they going to start getting the information to the blind in Braille and such? Not only just on the state level, but on the federal level.
I had put a couple years ago an article, this is Margie, in the Braille Forum. The IRS, their biggest secret is that they can and do put things in Braille. They have an alternative media center, and I could dig up that article and maybe put something in the BC. But it is there. You can get it. I'm not speaking of their websites. I'm speaking of getting documents in Braille from them.
I think it was in the last BC again, too.
Oh, it was?
Well, I didn't read the whole article, but there was a little blurb in there about accessible IRS.
Got to read your BC, I guess.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I love it when people ask questions and it's out there and they haven't done their homework.
Which month was it in, Donna?
Hey, Donna.
Yeah,
get a mic.
The winter.
I just wanted to say back to HR 3101. As chair of the Governmental Affairs Committee, working with a wonderful man, Frank Welty.
Yay.
We have an awesome committee. We need to contact our Congress people. We can't do it without each and every one of you doing that and helping with that. And Frank is always available to assist in writing. You know, if the comment about, you know, if you are concerned about writing a letter, so on and so forth. Frank is awesome. And we need each one of you because they want to hear from their people who live in their districts. When the delegation from California went to the Washington seminar, and Dan was a part of that delegation and Jeff was a part and there were a number of other people. We were successful in getting more Congress people to sign on, but we need more, and we need each and every one of you to help us make that happen. We're here to help. You're not alone. Give us a call. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Are there any other questions?
Hi, this is Sylvia Munoz. I know that you, Lainey, with the CCB, have worked on the Southwest Airlines website. And I used to be able to use it. Recently, in just 2 weeks, I tried using it, and I couldn't get anywhere. And I tried over 2 days. Have you gotten any other reports about it?
No, but just to clarify, Southwest Airlines was the subject of a lawsuit in Florida that went the wrong way. Uh-huh. And our involvement with that case was to do an amicus friend of the court brief when it went up to the Court of Appeal to try to get that reversed. So we have never had a direct relationship with Southwest Airlines. The issue with the airline websites is that airlines have a tricky relationship because airlines and some of airline activities are not covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. We're lucky in California that we have California laws that are stronger than the federal laws. So this is a good opportunity for me to give out Linda's toll-free telephone number. So if you have, to take Margie's point, if the website's not as accessible to you, you need to call on the phone, see what kind of response you get, send them an email, and document it. When it's time and you think it's an issue that could be looked at by Linda and I, and I need to be really clear, we can't and we don't do a structured negotiations for every call we get.
Right.
But we do try to take each call thoughtfully, and you may get a call back from someone in Linda's office. The best way to reach us, and I'll give out two pieces of information right now, Linda's office has a toll-free telephone number, and you can just call with your issue. You'll probably get a call back by one of the incredible paralegals they have in the office. The number is 1-800-822-5000. Repeat, 1-800-822-5000. And then the best way to reach us by email is at my email address, which is LF, my initials, at LF Legal. If you forget that, you can go through my website. There's a contact form with an accessible CAPTCHA that asks you how to spell a three-letter word that they give you the spelling right there. So,
Lainey, I just wanted to comment on the Southwest Airlines. You know, they established an 800 number for blind people to call to get the lowest internet fare on the phone. And when you call that number these days, the people who answer it don't understand what that line is all about.
Well, that brings home to me this separate but not equal issue. And I don't know who worked on that, but I certainly, as a consumer, as an advocate, would have never given a vote to do it that way, because it always fails in the end. Mm-hmm. It needs to be part of the mainstream system. Who worked on that, Bernice?
Lainey said it was a lawsuit in Florida.
I mean, the problem is there are Federal Aviation Administration regulations right now that mm-hmm. say if an airline website is not accessible, they can establish a policy to give the web price on the phone to people with disabilities who can't access the website. So advocacy efforts have to work around that. We still believe the law requires airline websites to be independently usable and accessible, and that a phone is not sufficient.
Yeah, and I think that addresses the, you know, there's a lot of attorneys out there that are taking on ADA issues and not settling them to the best of our interest.
That's right.
And
because they don't understand.
But it's about choices, because some people don't use the computer, so you still need those
yes.
online.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about choices. You need the
good point.
Web environment, and you need the accessible yeah. telephone mm-hmm. for those who don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
You need both.
Hi, Jane Cardis, Ukiah, California. Kathy Skybers had given me the number for Southwest Airlines. I called to make my reservations for the Phoenix Convention, and they were delightful with me, and there was no issue. I didn't have to debate about the problem once I told them that I was sight impaired for charges or anything. Many of the other airlines, United, being one that I used to fly all the time, they always put on a surcharge there if you did it over the telephone. And that's preferably my way. But I do have to say that I had no problem with Southwest, and I'll be flying to Phoenix on them.
That's great.
I'm going to throw in something because I think it's really important that we remember that all advocacy requires follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
You never have fixed the problem. You've only fixed the current set of issues, whatever they may be. But things change.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we have to be on top of it. Like I said, when the next baseball season comes around, I'm sure that I'm going to go and pound away at some other issues that didn't exist last time,
right.
but
oh.
will exist next time.
Jane, I want to say that at the October 2008 convention, Jean had a speaker from the FAA who told us that as of May, it was a specific date in the month of May, May 13th. Steve, maybe you should explain it better than I, that they can no longer charge you that surcharge.
The trouble is, as you've indicated, getting the people you talk to be aware of that fact.
I just would, if it's okay, is maybe the panel, if there's anyone who would, each person might be wanting to say a few closing comments, because we're very close to noon and
good.
Need to break. So I know Brian just did his. You know, does Kim want to do it?
Thank you. I think, you know, what I would just continue to say, and I think we've said it all throughout this session, is, you know, don't give up. You know, kind of embrace your issue, find your issue, and communicate with CCB, with Lainey, and work collaboratively, because that's really how we get the most things done, is working as a team, not acting as one person out there who's going to change this because it helps me, but that it helps you and benefits so many other people as well. So, you know, remember the bigger picture and stay with the goal. That's my message.
Yes. And my closing comment is, remember, it's a process. We need each and every one of you, and we need to remember that it's an educational process. Remember to document. And my final words is this. So many times I've heard people who are blind or visually impaired in the past say the ADA has done nothing for us. It's only done for people with mobility impairments. Our whole talk, for the most part today, is talking about how the ADA has, in fact, helped people who are blind and visually impaired. But it's like any other law, whether it's, driving laws or whatever, it's enforcement of it. And we are the enforcers. Thank you very much.
And Lainey.
I think my final word is just thank you, and it's a real honor to be on this panel up here with these incredible advocates, and it's an honor to be part of the CCB family, and I look forward to many more years of great advocacy until we put ourselves out of business by having a fully accessible world. Thank you.
Let's give them a hand, everyone. Okay, everyone, thank you. And at 1:30, the first general session. And if you're interested about access, tonight, during the second general session, we are going to have Christopher Downey, who is an architect who is totally blind. He's been blind just for about 2-3 years. We can talk about how he does the work, his work as an architect, a licensed architect. So look forward to hearing that this evening. Thank you.